Welcome to Business Trip, a podcast about the business of psychedelics. I'm Greg Kubin, and my co-host is Matthias Serebrinski. Matthias and I are partners at PsyMed Ventures, a fund investing in psychedelic medicine and mental health. This is part three of our three-part series about psychedelic research at Stanford, where the university is taking a multidisciplinary approach to studying psychedelic science, with researchers collaborating across departments. In this episode, we'll talk with Carolyn Rodriguez, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences. She's also the director of the Rodriguez Lab, which is a translational therapeutics lab. Carolyn investigates what happens in the brain during mental illness as a foundation to develop fast-acting treatments. And her psychedelic research focuses on obsessive-compulsive disorder. She has run multiple studies on ketamine's ability to treat OCD, and she plans to study the effects of MDMA and other psychedelics on OCD. In this episode, we'll discuss the symptoms of obsessive-compulsive disorder, how it presents in the brain, and the specific ways compounds like ketamine and MDMA may treat it. To the episode we go. Thank you, Carolyn. Really excited to have you on the podcast today. Let's start with an introduction about yourself, what your role is at Stanford.
I wear a couple different hats at Stanford. So I'm a professor in the Department of Psychiatry, and I'm the director of the Translational Therapeutics Lab. I'm also an associate dean in the Office of Academic Affairs, and I see psychiatry patients in the Palo Alto Veterans Administration.
And what led to your interest in ultimately researching psychedelics as it pertains to the relationship between psychedelics and psychiatry?
My inspiration for psychiatry really stems only just thinking about this interest that I had early on in the brain and the mind. My uncle, I'm originally from Puerto Rico, and my uncle suffered from schizophrenia. And what was fascinating about the time that I would spend with him is that he would be speaking to somebody who was not there. And anytime I would ask my family members, so what's going on? Like, why is that? It was sort of like hush, hush, like the stigma, but at the same time, like a real inclusiveness. There was not a sense that there was anything, he was just part of the family. And so that sort of dichotomy was really interesting to me. And also the fact that the mind could create a scenario in which somebody was speaking to him and he was having like a full conversation and dialogue with. And when I went to medical school, one of the first individuals that I encountered was somebody with mania. And again, there I was incredibly fascinated by the energy this individual had, the creativity, the enthusiasm for life. And that really tilted my trajectory toward psychiatry. And I had some background. I had did my PhD in neuroscience and trying to understand the basic biology of how the brain works. So those two areas had a nice intersection there. But then when I actually went to psychiatry residency, it really hit me how big of a gap there is between our understanding of the mind and thoughts, which continues to this day. And I really resolved that I wanted to be a researcher, a clinician and a researcher that was really at the interface of taking what we understand about the brain from a basic science perspective, but really trying to translate that and be more close to what patients are suffering with. And so I became really interested in obsessive compulsive disorder, again, inspired by a patient who had intrusive thoughts of contamination and had to wash his hands repeatedly. But what struck me about it is that you hear that a lot in sort of movies and things like that. But here was this person in front of me with gloves, and he would take off his gloves and his hands were all red and cracked. And you could just see the deep suffering. And so for me, the main treatment for obsessive compulsive disorder is either medications called serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or these are things like fluoxetine or Prozac, or cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a type of therapy where you expose somebody to the thing that they fear. And it helps about half of people, but half aren't helped. And so that really was the point where the inflection point in my career, where I wanted to look and see is there novel treatments, things that haven't been thought of before that could act rapidly, precisely based on what we understand about the neuroscience of obsessive compulsive disorder, and be able to be effective. And so the first compound in that spirit that I had success with was ketamine.
Can you briefly describe the brain mechanism behind OCD or how you understand it?
Yes. The short answer is it's unknown, right? I mean, I have so much humility. The more I learn about neuroscience, the more I'm in awe how little we know. So we don't know, where is a thought generated? How is it encoded in the brain? How is a repetitive behavior encoded in the brain? If we knew down to the molecular level how that works, we could intervene similarly or analogous to cancer therapeutics, where they're like precision, very targeted to the mechanism. So what we have in the field are hints and correlations as to what could be helpful. So in OCD, it's thought that there is a hyperactive loop between the orbitofrontal cortex, which is important for generating thoughts, the striatum, which is important for generating behaviors, the thalamus, which is a relay center, and then looping back. And so it's thought that that circuit is in such hyperactivity that there's really no brakes on it. There's no stop for those intrusive thoughts.
And so do you have a hypothesis as to how ketamine and or other psychedelics can intervene in that loop?
Yeah. So early on in my training, one of the things that I found really interesting was there was this animal model called the SATPAP3, in which a protein is disrupted in the glutamate pathway. So glutamate is the main excitatory neurotransmitter in the brain. And when that's disrupted in these animals, they groom themselves, they overgroom themselves, and so much so that there's like patches of skin. And they do this despite it harming them and harming their skin. So there's a compulsive nature to it. And what's interesting is that if you reintroduce the protein, you make it not disrupted in the striatum, which is the area of the brain that overlaps with this circuit in the animal model, the animal stops this overgrooming behavior. And so that piece of evidence that glutamate was important, along with the fact that patients with OCD, drugs that modulate the glutamate pathway, were starting to get kind of early read that they could be helpful in OCD. And then also Carlos Zarate had just replicated a Berman et al. Paper showing that a single infusion of low-dose ketamine rapidly decreased depression. So those three pieces together, it felt, oh, maybe this is something that could be tested in OCD patients. Maybe the time is right for us to really to bridge this hypothesis.
Usually interested, or there's a recurrent theme in many of my conversations, which is around the arbitrary or not arbitrary distinction between what is OCD, what is anxiety, what is depression. So I'm curious if you can speak about the similarities and differences when it comes to the biology of the disease, in the sense of glutamate is also involved with depression, and the idea of ruminative thoughts is also related to depression.
Definitely. Such a good question. Yeah. And I especially appreciate the thoughtfulness of the question, because I don't think nature is carved at its joints. And so it speaks to this sort of a hand is forced or hand is tipped in order to make categories so that people can be diagnosed and then be able to have something codable for insurance and things like that. So you see, it's forcing it in one way, but that may or may not be how our brain is, right? As a neuroscientist, it's a lot more complicated than that. So thinking about the underlying processes, and I love that you brought up rumination. So that's exactly why I think that the work that we're doing with OCD can be applicable to multiple domains. So there's a perseverative quality that sort of is a umbrella over things like ruminative thoughts and depressions, in which people are thinking about past things they did wrong or negative things, and it's difficult to stop those thoughts. With OCD, you have intrusive thoughts of contamination or harm that increase anxiety, and then compulsions, which are repetitive behaviors or thoughts that are used to neutralize that anxiety. Then you have PTSD, where you have intrusive thoughts of trauma from your past. And then also the perseverative quality that people have with suicidal thoughts. And some people have just continued thoughts. And so one underlying hypothesis that we're testing across a number of our studies is looking at this measure of cognitive control, which is the ability to stop and start thoughts. So as you can imagine, if you have this hyperactive loop with no breaks, understanding how cognitive control is a part of that and how you can actually impact and toggle to provide somebody with greater control or greater flexibility for people who have inflexibility of thought.
So I want to go back to this distinction between maybe environmental factors, genetic factors, physiological. How do you think of OCD in that context? Could OCD happen from genetic factors or environmental? One will trigger the other one. And also, is there a distinction when it comes to treatments?
It's a great question. And again, it's from the extant literature. It does seem like that families, that there are genetic qualities and families tend to have OCD relatives, but there isn't in terms of like we would say a GWAS or like a gene that is responsible for OCD that hasn't been identified yet. Geneticists would say that the studies that we do have on OCD and genetic risk factors, we don't have enough sample size. So when there are larger and larger pools of OCD patients that maybe will get over a certain threshold, we'll be able to identify that more. And I think, you know, the other, in terms of the environment, there is something called PANDAS, where people can have, kids can have a strep throat. And it's thought that creates an autoimmune reaction where the symptoms are similar to OCD. And, you know, if you're interested in that, there are really great groups that are focused on working on that. But for the most part, in OCD, the quarter of cases start by age 14. It happens in early teenage years. And what will happen is all of a sudden people will have like this thought, this wave of anxiety or this thought that just latches on. And it can actually morph into different kinds of themes. This one is not as common, but some people can have intrusive thoughts of harm where they'll be driving and they have an intrusive thought that they've run somebody over and they'll have to go around to the site of where they had that thought over and over, or they'll have to go home and watch the TV to see if they've run anybody over, any news about that. OCD is really limited by one's imagination. There's a comedian, Maria Bamford, who is really open about her harm OCD. And if you haven't checked out her comedy, she's fabulous. But I hope I'm remembering it right. It's that she has this fear that her parents will be chopped up into bits and then put on salad and she'll accidentally eat them. So it's like your imagination, OCD can put its hooks on you.
What about checking your passport 100 times when traveling?
Well, to meet criteria for OCD, I think all of us, I'm guilty as charged in terms of checking, and that can happen when we're anxious, right? But for OCD, you need to have intrusive thoughts and repetitive behaviors that last for more than an hour a day, for at least a year, and it causes impairment in your functioning. Some people can't date because they have intrusive thoughts of contamination. Like imagine that, like you can't have a relationship with somebody. So that's the level of impairment. Whereas probably, Greg, if you're speaking about yourself, checking your passport is good because then you'll have your passport.
It's true.
Okay, I would love for you to discuss your ketamine for OCD study, the 2013 study, and just share a little bit more about how it was designed and what you learned from it.
The intention behind it is that we wanted to try and understand in OCD patients who are unmedicated, whether a single infusion of ketamine at low dose, 0.5 mg per kg, was effective in reducing OCD symptoms. And so for that study, it was a small proof of concept study, and we randomized patients to ketamine or saline, which was the control. And we also included individuals who did not have severe comorbid depression. So we really wanted to understand no meds, no comorbid conditions, what was the effect? And what we found was that after a single infusion, when you ask patients on a scale of 0 to 10, 10 being constant intrusive obsessions and 0 being none, that there was a robust and dramatic decrease in intrusive thoughts within hours. And patients, some of them described it as a vacation from their OCD. And what's interesting is that when you continue to ask them out for 1 week, so long past when ketamine was metabolized in the body, so they were not anesthetized and it didn't have side effects, but long past that, patients continued to have, in some cases, complete cessation of their symptoms. And 1 week after the infusion was our primary outcome, and that involves an assessment called the Yale-Brown Obsessive-Compulsive Scale, which basically catalogs OCD severity of all the different kinds of themes, contamination, harm, symmetry, and exactness, all of the different kind of OCD symptoms that a person can have. And what we found that at 1 week, 50% of those individuals met clinically meaningful response, which is at least a 35% decrease in that Yale-Brown Obsessive-Compulsive Scale. For short, we call it the Y-Box. And so that was really exciting. It was the first time that a drug that we hypothesized took advantage of the glutamate modulating system. So ketamine is an NMDA receptor antagonist, as opposed to serotonin drugs, which are the first-line treatment for OCD. And this is the first time that we're seeing that this could be something that could really relieve symptoms on their own. And second, that it could relieve it so quickly, because it takes 8 to 10 weeks for medication, standard medication treatment. It can take months for the standard psychological treatment of cognitive and behavioral therapy. So from there, we went on to one of the most important questions, I think, in science: is this finding replicable? And so with NIH funding, we then went to conduct a double-blind, randomized controlled trial of ketamine compared to midazolam this time, which is active control. It makes people feel woozy and a little bit out of it. And that was funded by the National Institutes of Mental Health. And this is hot off the press, unpublished. So 45 OCD patients were randomized to ketamine, so in a 2-to-1 ratio. 30 ketamine and 15 got midazolam. And in that study, we found replication of our earlier work, which is wonderful to see. And we also saw that with a single infusion, we got significant clinical effects out to 3 weeks, but not 4 weeks, with a single infusion.
How do you make sense of this improvement when you think of what could be the mechanism of action, or what specifically happened here with a low dose administration of ketamine that produced these positive outcomes, not just the day off, but 3 weeks later as well?
So, well, we went on to actually ask the question of mechanism. So I'd spoken to you about this hyperactive loop between the front part of the brain and the striatum, the frontostriatal. And my inspiration for the SAPAP3 animal model of repetitive compulsive behavior. So with Lisa Ganaden at UCSF, we were actually able to do a reverse clinical trial in the SAPAP3 animal model, giving them ketamine. And so you can actually count the grooming bouts. And so we gave them a ketamine and saline. And we were able to show that indeed ketamine decreases the repetitive grooming bouts of the animals in the same time course. And further, using optogenetic tools and techniques, which you can actually study causality in animal models, you can use light to turn on certain neurons and turn them off. So we found, using these techniques, that ketamine increases activity in a frontotriatal circuit that causally controls compulsive grooming behavior, suggesting that circuit may be important for ketamine's therapeutic effects on OCD.
And how come it lasts at least 3 weeks? Because the half-life of ketamine is much, much shorter.
Yeah. I don't have an answer, a quantitative answer, but I have a speculation. Would you like to hear?
I would love to hear.
All right. So I think that what's interesting about the therapy that I told you about with cognitive behavioral therapy, you're exposing somebody to their worst fear and you're telling them not to do something, not to do the repetitive behavior. And in that therapy, you're actually unlinking the need to do a repetitive behavior that decreases the anxiety. Like, you can imagine that would be a little bit rewarding, right? So you have anxiety and you do this hand washing and then it feels better, but then another thought pops up. And so the loop reinforces, right? So in the therapy, you're saying, don't wash your hands, okay? And then you're disrupting this link. For some people, it may be that when you give them ketamine, they no longer have the thought and they just go about their business. So I wonder, is it because of the nature of OCD, you're getting this like self-exposure therapy, because now you can touch the doorknob and you can do all these things, right? And you're not, it's not being paired. So you're actually training that you can do all the things that you couldn't do before. You're exposing yourself to the very feared thing because you're not having the intrusive thought anymore for a while.
Mm. Yeah, it makes me think about a study where a participant has multiple ketamine infusions, not just one, over time. That thought just never sees the light of day again.
Exactly. The way the mind works, right? So we have habits, right? We brush our teeth every night, right? It's a habit. If somebody were to tell you, don't brush your teeth, probably if you go into your bathroom, you might try and reach for your toothbrush and then have to be like, oh, wait a second. No, I'm not doing my toothbrush. So it would be, and you probably do that for a while, right? It's hard to unlearn something that's so ingrained. And so if you have OCD for years and years and years, and OCD has well-trodden path, right? You would, and currently our therapy is one hour weekly, 2 hours weekly for several months. Can that compete with OCD, which is like just telling you this thing over and over and over? Like, which one would win, right? And so is this some way of artificially exposing yourself all the time by having a little relief in the thoughts?
Yep. Also, one other thing on this topic, it makes me think about the general role of therapy in conjunction with the ketamine treatment. And it sounds like for some people, therapy just may not even be necessary because the thought is no longer presenting itself.
I don't know that. We're tracking people out to see, and I am humble with OCD. OCD is very strong, right? And so I ascribe to the model that one size doesn't fit all. And it may be that this gets to this idea of what's the best therapy for whom? And is there an optimal combination of things that can help people? So is it medication? Is it ketamine? Is it therapy? Is it neuromodulation? And there too, when you hear about something, so in OCD, it has deep brain stimulation, has compassionate use exception, where you have a device that is actually stimulating a part of the OCD circuit or inhibiting it, depending on which procedure is being used. And that is a very strong counter signal, right? If you have that stimulation on all the time, and it's effective for people who have it, even though there are side effects. But I think there, in terms of like as a wearing my neuroscience hat, you could get the competition for OCD, right?
Yep. So what do you want to study next?
So I think following up, Greg, on your and Matthias's question about what's the mechanism, what's going on. So the study that I just mentioned that we're getting great clinical results. We actually, those participants who participated in our study were in a scanner at the same time they were getting the ketamine infusions. So we have magnetic resonance spectroscopy. This is a way to non-invasively look at changes in glutamate, glutamine, and GABA, which is an inhibitory compound. And you can use that technique to really laser in on one region of the OCD circuit. And you can say, are these neurotransmitters that we hypothesized to be changing actually changing? And does that relate to the symptom change? Maybe it changes, but maybe it bears no relationship to the symptoms. And we also have fMRI, which is a way that you can actually kind of with bold signal see the activity of these different kind of loops and circuits. And so we're looking at two different loops that could be important in OCD with that at baseline and then 24 hours post. And then if that weren't enough, these individuals are troopers. They also had an EEG cap on. So we have EEG and fMRI, EEG in the scanner with magnetic resonance spectroscopy so that we can ask these very specific questions. What is happening in the brain? What is happening in the brain in responders versus non-responders? Can we predict, are any of these things signals as to who would have responded? And are any of them important for the change? Mm-hmm. So that's next for that project. We also have funding to look at a metabolite of ketamine called RRHNK, which has less side effects, less dissociation and other side effects than ketamine. And then finally, we're to loop back to the area of empathogens and psychedelics. We have funding from the Foundation for OCD Research and collaborating closely with MAPS to test MDMA for OCD.
Wow, love it.
So about MDMA for OCD, it sounds like the way that you explained how ketamine could be effective for OCD is very specific to ketamine, right? Like in the sense of the agonism activity and what is activating or downregulating. What is the hypothesis for MDMA?
Yes, we have several hypotheses. And one of the ones that we can test with the funding that we have is this idea that MDMA has pro-social benefits. The therapy, the gold standard therapy, is cognitive behavioral therapy with exposure. So you're doing something that is, you're telling somebody, let's do the thing that you most fear right now. And it's hard to get buy-in. You need to trust the person and you need to go with them. And a lot of people don't do one of our gold standard treatments in OCD because they're scared or it's hard, right? And so the idea is, could MDMA be that thing that sort of really helps bond and connect the person and have them have good connection and good association to the therapist? And so what we're testing is MDMA compared to D-methamphetamine, which is the most robust control for MDMA. And typically, a lot of the studies I see don't have really robust controls. And so we really wanted to have the most rigorous one. And then we would do 10 sessions of exposure and response prevention, but in a very abbreviated time. So the idea is just a proof of concept. Does MDMA help decrease symptoms when augmented with exposure and response prevention? And furthermore, does it separate from just an amphetamine, the methamphetamine, in terms of actually having benefits above and beyond?
Okay, we're going to move to the rapid fire round of the interview. So we have a couple questions for you.
Okay.
So my first question is, are you interested in commercializing your research?
Where I see myself on the continuum is de-risking compounds so that they will be attractive for companies or others to then be able to have the machinery and infrastructure to run larger studies. I see that as a unique niche because we have NIH funding on one side and we have basic science, but there's something called the Valley of Death where all these promising compounds then fall off the curve. And so much so that the pharmaceutical industry really backed way out. And so I've always been like, this is interesting. It's got a good mechanism, a good rationale, and trying to stimulate that piece of it. Perhaps not at the commercialization stage, but certainly in support of companies to take promising candidates that were de-risking and being able to use them in their portfolios.
What are alternatives to CBT that are not mainstream yet, but could be more popular or more used in the future?
I don't know of any that have a large evidence base, but there are definitely things like Mediterranean diet. There's like a few studies on that. Mindfulness meditation. There are one-offs like that. The American Psychiatric Association has a treatment guideline that ranks things by evidence base. So certainly medications and therapy are the first line. But I would say is FDA has approved transcranial magnetic stimulation. And also deep brain stimulation has compassionate use. And I'm excited that there are different modalities and certainly always keeping my eye out.
What would it take for insurance to cover ketamine infusions for OCD?
This is an interesting question in the sense that I know that our work is already being cited at ketamine clinics as being efficacious and that people are getting this already in private clinics. And I have always been a proponent, not ready for prime time. We still need more evidence base. Even with this latest study that we have, it will raise more questions, which is at what frequency should you dose ketamine? Who will be helped from it? Who will not? So there's still a lot of questions out there about it. Because ketamine is already FDA approved and people are already using it off-label, I don't see a path where somebody would take it and then commercialize it. Unless it's something like there's a company that, for example, has the intranasal formulation for ketamine that's used in depression and that has a very specific indication, a very specific use. So it's possible it could go that route.
The study that you did in 2013 and the follow-up studies, the kind of the endpoint was measured by an OCD scale. Are there more objective biomarkers that you are excited about?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited just first to see what the results are of the fMRI, MRS markers. But we've also added in something I'm really excited about. So it's Web Neuro and Total Brain. And with our partner, Lee Williams, we've added in remote batteries that you can take that you can actually do different tasks, look at executive memory, attention, and cognitive control, which is what I was talking about before. So wouldn't it be cool if cognitive control could be measured, could be embedded in clinical trials in the future, and could give you a window into who will respond and potentially even how patients are doing? So their ability to inhibit thoughts, and not just for OCD, but across disorders.
What is the key to getting funding for research?
This is something that I think I have thought a lot about and continue to think a lot about because one, the most exciting work that I do has been funded by donors. Why? Because as an investigator, you have an idea, you have something that you want to translate. It took me a year between the time I had the idea of to try ketamine and OCD to actually do it because who's going to fund me? It turned out this donor gave me $7,000 to do one infusion. People were like, you want to do, the IRB was like, you want to do what now? You want to give an infusion to patients? That was unheard of at the time. And I had to cold knock on anesthesiologist doors to have an anesthesiologist present because that was one of the requirements for the IRB. And luckily somebody came aboard. So there's a lot of things like that where just a little bit of money, a little bit of infrastructure, you can actually test out different ideas that are coming directly from basic science in humans. And you can fast forward through that valley of death so quickly if you just have some promising candidates, test them in OCD, and see if it can be helpful or not. I think donor funding is something that I think is so helpful and has made a big impact in my career. And then in terms of funding, National Institutes of Mental Health, they fund projects that are advanced or like de-risked already, and for the purposes of studying the mechanism. But that doesn't necessarily get us closer to treatments, right? And then companies are looking to make a good investment. So they want things that are already de-risked. So that's the landscape.
Is there a connection between OCD and addiction?
There have been a lot of nice work looking at this. And from what I had talked about before, you can see there's evidence of dysfunctional reward circuitry in OCD. So that's a parallel. And there is a quality, a rewarding quality to when you do the compulsion and your anxiety goes down, you feel better. And so there is this kind of seeking behavior. But it is very different, as I've described to you, OCD is driven by the intrusive thoughts that increase anxiety as opposed to in addiction, where it is a substance, it is something that then is actually changing the physiology of your brain, where if you don't have that substance anymore, then you exhibit withdrawal symptoms. So it's slightly different, but certainly, as we've already mentioned, that nature is not carved at its joints, and there are overlapping features, I think.
all the way at the beginning of the conversation when you talked about your ankle, and then when you mentioned your first patient that was experiencing mania, there was something about that you didn't categorize as negative, right? It felt like these are things that someone was experiencing and there were maybe benefits or maybe some beauty in experiencing that. So I'm curious on how you think about what I mentioned in the context of both you as a human living in this society and also as a physician and practitioner and scientist.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity to comment, because this is something that I feel is, I think, untapped potential. I don't know who would fund it or how we would fund it. But on the flip side, I think of every mental illness, there is beauty, there is creativity. There are windows that we have into how people think differently. So for example, ADHD. Individuals with ADHD are some of the most creative, thoughtful people, and their brain just works differently. And we're focused on helping them to have attention to function in our school system or in checking boxes and things like that. And yet nobody is really studying what makes the creativity. Why are this person's thoughts different? NIMH isn't going to fund that, right? That part isn't the disorder part. We're really focused on the disorder. People with a hoarding disorder, they keep things because of the promise of what could happen, you know, what could be. They don't want to be wasteful. They have so many ideas of what a single object could be, what kind of art projects they could do, all these things, right? So their mind is expanding. They see beauty in everyday objects. So things like a bottle cap, which you and I would think nothing of, somebody with hoarding disorder would say, look at the beauty. I've never seen a bottle cap like this. And look how it shines in the light. And look at this. And so it's this like hyper awareness and appreciation and beauty in everyday things, which I think is really amazing.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. This was a fantastic interview. And if you have any final thoughts or anything you want to share, this is an opportunity to do so.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to thank you guys for what you do. It is so important to get this conversations about mental health, about research, thinking about things creatively. And it has really been a joy just to spend time with you guys and, you know, hear your thoughtful questions. And it gives me energy in terms of what we want to study and what we want to advocate for. So I'm a big fan. Keep doing what you're doing and really cheering you guys on.
Awesome. Thank you.
This is Business Trip, a podcast about the business of psychedelics. Thanks for tuning in to our three-part series about Stanford's psychedelic research. If you like this series, this episode, or Business Trip in general, you can help us by subscribing to the podcast and leaving a review. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SciMedVentures. And if you're building a company in frontier mental health, hit us up at hi@scimed.ventures, which you can find in the show notes. I'm Greg Kubin, and my co-host is Matthias Serebrinski. Our producer and editor is Jonathan Davis, with production coordination from Caitlin Nerd. Sound design and engineering came from Nico Ray. Our theme music is by Dorian Love, and additional music credits are in the show notes. This is Business Trip. Thanks for tripping with us. We'll see you next time.